From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Although some of Florida's Republican leaders seem to be backing off their support, a referendum on property taxes will still be on the November ballot.
Property taxes are what help pay for things like police and fire protection, emergency management, garbage pickup.
Also this week, if you're running for governor in Florida, you have to be a full-time Florida resident. And there's controversy about one candidate's residency.
This case centered on his whether or not he was a permanent resident in Washington, D.C.
We'll also look at how big data centers could impact Florida's freshwater supplies, and we'll go swimming with the sharks. I'm Tom Flanagan. On air and online, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Proposed Constitutional Amendment 3 is an item on the November ballot. If passed, it would significantly reduce Floridians' property tax burdens by increasing what's known as the homestead exemption, or the amount of property value exempt from being taxed. Currently, Florida's exemption sits at $50,000, but Amendment 3 aims to raise it to $150,000 next year and to $250,000 in 2028. Property taxes are a massive source of general revenue for small municipalities that don't have much commercial activity and have low property values. For them, the passage of Amendment 3 would mean a dire lack of funding for public services and the potential shutting of City Hall doors. WGCU's Emma Rodriguez spoke with Kate Payne, state government reporter for the Florida Trib. Payne's reporting on Amendment 3's possible impact took her to the town of Bowling Green, where passage is a worst-case scenario.
What motivated state lawmakers to get this amendment on the ballot?
So we're seeing actually across the country what some have called a property tax revolt playing out. And that's because housing prices have really soared since the pandemic, far outpacing inflation. And we're seeing that across the country. And local governments have benefited from this by pulling in more tax revenues, not by raising tax rates necessarily, but simply collecting more revenues on homes that are now worth significantly more. Local governments would also tell you everything has gotten more expensive for them, just like it has for everybody else. But really, it was Republican Governor Ron DeSantis who, for about a year now, has been ringing this bell about property taxes and arguing we should do away with them entirely. And he pushed the Republican-controlled state legislature to hold a special session to pass his proposal on this. Lawmakers did amend that proposal, carving out school-related taxes. Homeowners will still have to pay those school taxes, but they took up this proposal from the governor's office.
With that lack of tax dollars, of course, comes a lack of funding for municipal services. What are some examples of those, and why are they essential for residents?
Property taxes are what help pay for things like police and fire protection, emergency management, garbage pickup, road maintenance, public health services, local parks, public libraries, and also drinking water and sewage treatment. Public safety is a huge part of this picture. In 55 of Florida's 67 counties, public safety is the single largest line item in their budget.
Your reporting took you to the small, low-income town of Bowling Green in Hardy County. You spoke to their mayor, Sam Feit, about how Amendment 3's passage would really hurt the town and other small municipalities in the state. What are his biggest worries?
He's not giving up on his town. You know, he's optimistic by nature, and he'll still be optimistic when they have to lock up City Hall and close it for good. And he kind of jokes about how he already has a burial plot picked out in the town cemetery, and he hopes that the town itself will still be alive when the time comes, because right now, a quarter of the town's general revenue comes from property taxes. And in Bowling Green, 98% of the homesteaded properties are already worth less than $250,000. So this measure, if voters pass it, would effectively wipe out property taxes in this town. This would leave just 20 homeowners in town whose houses are worth more than $250,000. So 20 people to essentially be paying the full cost for everyone else in town, which raises some real questions.
And on top of Mayor Fight, you sat down with other Bowling Green residents. What's the range of emotions and opinions you're seeing from them, especially those folks whose families have been in Bowling Green for generations?
So this is a very conservative area, not people who want big government and a lot of taxes, for sure. But there were a lot of people who really said, you know, wait a minute, what about police? What about the fire department? And they understand that those services are made possible by property taxes.
Lastly, Kate, in the event that Amendment 3 passes, what's the fallback plan? Have you heard anything from Bowling Green or any other small municipalities?
So they're all poring over their municipal budgets, you know, looking for places to cut. But again, communities like this have so little wiggle room, so few options. Bowling Green has one garbage truck. So where can we cut back is a real question. And speaking with the mayor, he did talk about things like raising utility fees, you know, trying to recoup these revenues in other ways through potentially new fees, you know, in places like Bowling Green, really sort of vulnerable local economies that are already on the brink. They're going to be really hard questions.
That was Florida Trib reporter Kate Payne speaking with WGCU's Emma Rodriguez. As Florida's election season heats up, two high-profile legal battles took place in Leon County Court over the past 2 weeks. One judge made a decision in a challenge to a gubernatorial candidate's ballot eligibility, and another is mulling whether the wording of that proposed property tax amendment should be rewritten before voters cast their ballots. WFSU's Tristan Wood spoke with WUSF state reporter Douglas Soule about what's at stake.
So, Douglas, I've been following from the stories you put out and also your posts on social media that you've spent a lot of time in court the last 2 weeks.
Tristan, that's right. The Leon County Courthouse has been a second home these last couple weeks. I've probably spent $100 at the vending machine.
Gotcha on that. Aside from, you know, what you use to fill your stomach, let's talk about what's filling your brain when you were physically there. I know the first case you were there for was kind of the James Fishback. You know, he's one of the candidates running for governor, kind of his ballot eligibility case. Walk us through why that case was there.
This was an incredibly interesting case. Here's a situation where one candidate challenged the eligibility of another, Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, who's also running in the GOP primary for governor, questioned the ability to run of James Fishback. He's an investor, and he's also a pretty controversial candidate, James Fishback is. Some critics have accused him of racism and anti-Semitism. He denies that, but there's a lot of James Fishback stuff on Twitter if you just take a scroll through a Florida political algorithm.
Yeah, I know some of his comments that he said. He's called Byron Donalds, the front runner of that race, said that he's a slave to Israel. Byron Donalds is, of course, a black man. And that's one of several types of comments he's made. What's at the center question about whether he was eligible for the ballot or not? Kind of what was going on there?
Yeah, those controversial comments aren't a part of this case. This case centered on his whether or not he was a permanent resident in Washington, D.C. in the early 2020s. The Collins team, they pointed to the fact that Fishback registered to vote and voted in D.C. in 2020. Fishback also bought a condo in D.C. in 2021, and on mortgage paperwork, he listed it as his primary residence. Fishback, interestingly to me, as I watched this hearing, didn't deny those two things. He said that he inadvertently registered in D.C. He said he walked into a polling place to vote for Trump in 2020. And in 2021, when he signed the mortgage paperwork, he said he did it in a rush. He called that condo in D.C. a place that he had to visit his parents. And he said that it was an investment property. The judge ultimately said that Fishback, at least Team Collins, couldn't prove that he ever intended D.C. as his permanent residence, that he was good to run in this election cycle.
The other issue that you were in Leon County Court over the last 2 weeks for is equally, if not more important, a kind of concerns related to this property tax ballot initiative. What was at what kind of the issue ongoing with why it was in court?
So a little context to our listeners here. If you don't recall, it's so much happened this spring and early summer that this a reminder is needed here. The lawmakers here in Florida, they called, well, I believe DeSantis called a special session to lower the property tax. The lawmakers came in and had a special session. They lowered the and they passed a proposal that would lower the property tax. It didn't go as far as Governor Ron DeSantis wanted, so he's saying he's not going to campaign for it. Regardless, it would dramatically reduce some of the revenues for local governments. Local governments are concerned that it could impact the ability to carry out some important local services. That being said, that is not a part of the litigation that I covered this week. Multiple parties have accused the summary and the ballot proposal's title of being misleading and too biased. So they're wanting new wording to be on place. And this wording is what voters would see on the ballot. And at least 60% of voters need to approve that proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot for it to become law of the land.
Understood. So, kind of, I know the decision from that case isn't out yet, right?
It is not. The judge asked the parties to submit proposed rulings by the end of Monday, 5 p.m. Monday. I would imagine that ruling would come soon. I don't want to say for sure next week, but obviously a decision needs to be made very, very quickly because the election is so close.
Awesome, Douglas. Thank you so much for the time. I appreciate you.
It's always good to talk to you, Tristan. Excited for next time.
All right. Have a good one. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it.
That was WFSU's Tristan Wood speaking with WUSF's Douglas Soule. Well, with that August 18th primary less than 3 weeks away, former House Speaker Paul Renner is trying to climb up the polls and drag down U.S. Representative Byron Donalds in the Republican gubernatorial primary. Renner says Donalds is ignoring base Republican voters in his campaign, especially by refusing to debate him, Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, and conservative activist and investor James Fishback, who we just talked about. On the campaign trail, Renner touts his record as House Speaker from 2022 to 2024, when he helped shepherd much of Governor Ron DeSantis' agenda into law. He also acknowledged DeSantis, who is term limited, hasn't helped consolidate a coalition to defeat Donalds, the GOP frontrunner, who's been endorsed by President Donald Trump.
Well, the governor obviously could help in consolidating, but you're right that he doesn't want Donalds. He's said as much publicly many times, and so. But we see momentum. I mean, nonetheless, we see momentum that people want the adult in the room.
Polling shows Donalds leading Renner, Collins, Fishback, and seven other Republican candidates for the GOP nomination. Coming up on Capitol Report, water is Florida's most precious commodity. We'll explore how that might be impacted by proposed AI data centers.
Approving any sort of request for zoning change or approving a data center, they need to know from their water management district, how is this going to affect the water availability in our area?
If you think it seems there are more sharks around nowadays, you're not wrong.
For anybody who's been in Florida for 30 years or so, it may look like the shark populations have really increased, and that's because they have.
The first half of this year brought extreme or exceptional drought to the vast majority of Florida, and this has persisted in many areas. The effects are visible in water bodies connected to the Floridan aquifer. In WFSU's latest Coast to Canopy podcast, we look at water usage in Florida, how it has affected the springs, and we consider the potential effects of AI data centers on Florida's groundwater. For this excerpt, host Rob Diaz-DeVillegas sat down with, in this order, Haley Moody, director of the Florida Springs Institute, and Kelly Keyes, communications director at the FSU Wakulla Springs Lab.
There are certainly things that we can do in our own homes to save water. But there are some allocations that seem to be a little out of proportion. and it gets really challenging when we're in times of drought to really ask people to, you know, do what they can to save water. I know in the Tampa Bay region, like, restaurants had stopped serving cups of water to the people that were coming to patronize their restaurants. They had to actually ask for water. So those things are a little hard to swallow when so much water is being allocated for a single permit for an industry like phosphate mining.
Are there a lot of industrial permits issued in Florida? Because it seems like it's not like a huge amount of number, but that each individual user might use a lot.
So there are quite a few. And again, some will use more water than others. This particular phosphate mine up in White Springs, for example, is allocated over 60 million gallons per day, which is really significant. So I know bottled water gets a lot of attention, but across the state, I think it's all bottled water permits are somewhere around 6 million gallons per day. So that's quite a difference in terms of what people know about and what people are talking about and what people are really advocating for and against. I do think it's important that people have that information. They understand where this water is going.
So we, the consumers, are the ones using most of it right now. A lot of counties are considering whether or not they want to open up for having AI data centers, which are reputably known as taking a lot of water. What would that mean, having AI data centers taking water from the aquifer?
This is a hot topic right now. It is this sort of new industry. It is sort of this new thing being proposed in Florida. It has come pretty quickly, I think. But this is what I will say about data centers. A medium-sized data center could use as much as 300,000 gallons per day. A large-scale data center could use as much as 5 million gallons per day. There are different types of systems. There are open-loop and closed-loop systems. But they both have both a direct water use and an indirect water use. And we just have to keep a careful eye on both of those, because the indirect water use from the electricity consumption can actually be quite large, even in those closed loop systems. This becomes really challenging when we see proposals for data centers show up within spring sheds of outstanding Florida springs, for example. There have been 30 outstanding Florida springs designated by the Florida Springs and Aquifer Protection Act of 2016. And those springs actually have legal protections. For example, it wasn't exactly a data center proposal, but it was a land use change in order to sort of move in that direction of a data center in Citrus County recently that was in the Kings Bay Crystal River Springshed at Holder Industrial Park. And it was just a couple of weeks ago that this land use change in order to facilitate a large-scale data center came before the Planning and Development Commission down there in Citrus County, and they actually denied the request. And this was partially because of the public outcry, because so many people showed up to fight back against this. In these situations, what really needs to happen is that whether it comes before the county commission or whether it comes before the planning and zoning board or planning and development board, they both really need to be in very close communication with the water management district. Whatever water management district they're in, they need to make sure that they are requesting a water availability study before approving any sort of request for zoning change or approving a data center. They need to know from their water management district, how is this going to affect the water availability in our area? And if there is an outstanding Florida spring, how will it affect the minimum flow and level that's been established for that spring, or an outstanding Florida water, for that matter, that has a minimum flow and level? the counties and the planning and zoning boards, they really need to lean into the water management districts for that information, for the water modeling, because they're not going to have that information. They're going to need to get that from their districts. So that would be my recommendation moving forward. You know, we also have this situation here in Florida with our Lime Rock aquifer. We have sinkholes that form.
Right.
And our water use actually has a lot to do with that. Because we have this vast underground aquifer, in a lot of places in Florida, it's the water that's holding up the land above it. And if that water level drops, and it drops too quickly, the land can drop right along with it. And this is something that, again, if a county or an area is considering bringing a data center, they need to be really clear about that impact of the water use, because sinkholes could open up. And they need to know about that. And they, again, can request a sinkhole susceptibility study from the water management district for the water use.
Tallahassee area, we don't have, at least within the Wakulla Springs, there's some agriculture, but not as heavy as other places in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then we don't have any industrial uses of water here, but in other parts of the state, that's more of a thing. So talk about if we were to get, like, say, and I know there's a recent moratorium was passed on AI data centers in Leon County, which isn't a permanent stop to that, but just for a while, we're not going to consider it. Yeah. But if we were to get an AI data center sort of in the Wakulla Springs, so what would that mean for the amount of water that would be taken from that part of the aquifer?
And Wakulla County passed that as well as Leon. So I can't speak scientifically, you know, and I'm not going to specifically about a data center, but in a more general sense, right? Like, we live in the East Coast and we know we have a lot of water here, right? And trends are showing even that, like, maybe even slightly wetter, obviously not this past year, but slightly wetter. But we have a lot of rain. We have a lot of water. We have a lot of springs. But sometimes it gets really dry. We know in Tallahassee, our sinkhole lakes sometimes get low. Those are natural cycles. And the animals and the entire ecosystem, all of the habitat, all of that is dependent on that amount of water and sometimes that fluctuation of water. And so taking a lot of water out of that system, obviously the ecosystem has, over, you know, millennia, has grown to depend on the amount of water as it exists. Yeah. That's what I would say generally, is that us humans taking a lot out, that we want to think hard about that because of the ecosystems around here.
That was Rob Diaz de Villegas speaking with Haley Moody, director of the Florida Springs Institute, and Kelly Keyes, communications director at the FSU Wakulla Springs Lab. Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer is putting the Roman Catholic Church on notice. If they take taxpayer-funded vouchers for their schools, they should accept vaccine exemptions for their students. In a letter sent today to the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops, Uthmeyer, citing the Catholic Catechism, Pope Leo, and Scripture, argued Catholic doctrine does not allow its schools to reject vaccine exemptions for religious reasons. The letter comes 10 days before most school districts in the state open their doors for the 2026-2027 school year. Many Catholic schools in Florida accept students who pay tuition with help from the state's private school vouchers. Currently, more than 500,000 students across the state take part in the program. As of March 2026, about a quarter of the state's education budget goes to voucher programs. That's up from 12% in 2021. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after a shark attack earlier this summer left a swimmer in Panama City with severe injuries to both arms, some residents along the Gulf Coast are thinking twice about getting in the water. But as Randy Buxta with the Rural News Service reports, experts say shark attacks remain exceedingly rare.
Recently, residents gathered at T.H. Stone Memorial St. Joseph Peninsula State Park to listen to Wewahitchka shark fisher Travis Lucas. Lucas catches and tags sharks along the Gulf for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. The tag allows NOAA to track and monitor the shark population and migration patterns.
We focus a lot of our productivity and our outreach to the sharks to tag and release for NOAA. So we will stick a tag in them. We send all the information over to NOAA. They can track migratory patterns of these species. They help kind of understand the breeding process, what sharks are in what area.
Lucas says sharks are part of the ocean, but he says there are simple steps swimmers can take to help protect themselves, including removing electronics like smart watches before getting in the water, since Lucas says they could attract sharks.
If we be mindful when we're in the water, anything that puts off electric, we're seeing more now because there's a lot of waterproof electronics, smartwatches and as such. And where to us, we don't feel it. Sharks hunt by the incozema in their nose, which is a gel product that senses electromagnetic fields.
Other important safety steps include paying attention to where you're swimming and being sure to swim in a group, says Gavin Naylor, who runs the website International Shark Attack Files.
When you see bait fish close into shore, don't go swimming. Also, we shouldn't go swimming on our own because you're more likely to look like a curiosity. If you're with a group of people splashing around, you make a lot of noise, then the sharks are going to do their level best to avoid you.
Naylor says shark attacks are a very rare occurrence in Florida. His record shows the attack in Panama City was just the 10th unprovoked attack reported in the area since 1900. According to data from the University of Florida Shark Research Program, only one attack in the last 20 years was fatal in the Gulf area. Dean Grubbs at FSU's Coastal Marine Lab says that there are several factors for why the shark attacks are more common than they were 30 years ago, but points to the population of sharks increasing as well as more people using the water.
For anybody who's been in Florida for 30 years or so, it may look like the shark populations have really increased, and that's because they have. Because 30 years ago, our populations of sharks were at their minimum. They had been severely overfished. And so they've been recovering. And this includes black-tipped sharks, you know, tiger sharks, bull sharks, you name it. For those that have been fishing in this region for 50 years or more, where it's getting back to where it used to be. But at that same time that these shark populations have been increasing over the last 30 years, the number of people that you're using the water has also increased.
Grubbs said that one of his biggest concerns is whether the general public is ready to coexist with a healthy shark population.
One of them is, are humans ready for healthy shark populations? Are we ready to live with healthy shark populations? You know, we want a healthy marine ecosystem that includes healthy shark populations as part of that. And so for those folks that have been in Florida for, 20 or 30 years, it seems like the shark populations are out of hand, but really it's just getting back into some of balance.
And for Tammy Stephanie, a local resident on the Gulf, coexisting with sharks is part of the beauty of the Gulf Coast.
We are lucky to live here in the Gulf, and sharks are part of it. Without them, we wouldn't have the beautiful Gulf that we have.
While Grubbs says the population is increasing, he says residents do not need to be afraid of going into the water. Just keep an eye out for anyone bait fishing, do not swim alone, and leave the electronics on the beach. In Gulf County, for the Rural News Service, I'm Rennie Buxta.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Emma Rodriguez, Douglas Saul, and Rob Diaz de Villegas. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.